You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Russ Caswell from the Motel Caswell up in Massachusetts. Russ, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Russ, we spoke several times in the past. Of course, you are the man who was a victim of the U.S. government coming after you with their civil forfeiture division. And of course, what that has to do with is they target mostly innocent people and they can legally steal their property, which they tried to do for you. Of course, fortunately for you and for all people who are concerned about matters like this, the government lost and they lost bad. And just last week, on Tuesday, July 16th, over in Washington, D.C., there was actually an event, a legislative briefing on the need to reform federal civil forfeiture laws. And you were invited there and you testified there. I want to get into that in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, I just want to bring them up to date a little bit. Of course, what I wrote here, I'm just going to read exactly what I wrote here. Russ Caswell, an ordinary, hardworking, law-abiding American citizen, I said is, but it's now was, fortunately, was caught in an evil, unconstitutional, legal game that could cost him everything him and his family have worked for their whole lives. Russ didn't break any laws, has never been arrested nor convicted of anything, but that's not going to stop the federal government or the federal and local government team from trying to steal his mortgage-free property legally using so-called civil forfeiture statutes. And of course, this was back in March of 2012, and then we spoke again, and the interview went up in January of 2013, and I'll just read briefly here that in over the three-year saga of the Motel Caswell civil forfeiture case, the United States Department of Justice, under the direction of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, and that was Harmon M. Ortiz, just suffered a stinging defeat after a U.S. magistrate judge ruled that the, quote, government has not met its burden of proving a substantial connection between the Motel Caswell and the forfeitable crimes, and therefore has not met its burden of proving that the property is forfeitable. And of course, what they were trying to do was tie you in with the very, very few drug-related crimes that occurred on your property in your motel over the course of, I guess it was a decade, and statistically it was insignificant. Isn't that right, Russ?
Yes. It was just a minute amount of the people that have stayed there have done some kind of drug thing in it. From what I understand, most of it was just minor stuff, all done behind closed doors in a motel room, which I have no way of knowing what somebody's doing inside their own motel room. And we rent over that period of time they talked about different periods of time, but it came down to roughly one case per year. If you average it out, some years there were none. We rent over a year, maybe 14,000 rooms, 14,000 rooms, it varies. And they picked out these roughly one case a year. They had like, I think, 15 different cases, most of which, if not all, but I think one of them, I never even knew existed. I was never even called to court to testify about anything to do with these things. And some of them going way, way back that the police never even told me about. I've seen the police in the yard. You know, they might come in and go to a room, but when I go out to try to find out what they're doing, they won't tell you anything. And then I got these notices in the mail. I never had a warning about anything. Nobody from the town had ever said anything to me or sent me any letters, you know, the town manager or anybody. And we get inspected maybe a dozen times a year by the health department, fire department, and so on. And nobody has a problem with us. And they give me a license to operate every year. No questions about anything I should be doing any different at all. And then one day I get the mail and these two notices in there. One for me and one was for my wife. And it says, we're taking your property. And I was just dumbfounded. I thought it was a mistake. So I talked to a few people and they said, well, you probably ought to get a lawyer and find out what this is about. So I did. I got a hold of my lawyer that I use all the time for other legal things, wills and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was telling him about it. He was puzzled by it. He said, you mean nobody ever talked to you about anything there? And I said, no, nothing. So I went down there and had a meeting with him and another person in his office that knew a little bit more about this stuff. And I still think about this. I'm down there and I'm telling this other lawyer the story, and he's kind of got this look on his face like, there's got to be more to this. There's something you're not telling me. He even admits it now. He was skeptical when I first told him the story. So we deposed like 8 of the police that were involved in these cases that they were using against me. And I was even more shocked after we deposed the police, because I thought, you know, something would come out that they either thought I did, or they thought somebody at the motel, somebody that worked there did, or something. And it's like the police, maybe not they wanted to be, but they had nothing bad to say about me or anybody at the motel or anything that had gone on here. They all said how we cooperate with them all the time, and we even give them rooms for surveillance if they want to watch somebody else or that kind of thing. And they come in and check the registration cards, and we never interfere with them. I was just more puzzled after that, because it's like there was nothing against us at all. There was no misunderstanding, and I felt like getting up at the end of the deposition and said, what are we even doing here? You know, it was just, it was bizarre. It was so puzzling. I'm still puzzled by the whole thing.
Right.
But I have learned since we went through this whole trial thing and everything, the way they do this, I asked my lawyer, Scott Bullock from the Institute for Justice, I said, I can't imagine when we get into court, what are they going to say that I did? And he says, I really don't know. He couldn't understand why they didn't drop it. And so we got into court, and they used all these vague things like, well, he should have known, he could have known, why didn't he know, and all this blind eye stuff. And when we questioned about, well, what do you mean? Just what specifically you're talking about? They could come up with nothing specific. It was just all this vagueness. They're just not used to people fighting back, because you simply can't afford it. They have all the money in the world to do this to people. So a lot of people just give up because it would cost more to fight it than they would get out of it. But fortunately for me, the Institute for Justice saw this case, and they were kind of like, boy, this is something else. So they came on board and defended me for nothing.
Right.
I would have lost. I mean, it's a matter of affordability. It's not a case of you've done anything wrong or not. One of the spokesmen even said in a newspaper article, she says, well, no, we have nothing against Mr. Caswell. It's his property. It's like the motel put a mask on and ran around town, you know, holding up people. It's just, it's bizarre the way these people do this stuff. You're accused of nothing, and yet they want to take, the property's worth over $1.5 million, and they want to come in and just take it from you and never even accuse you of anything, never mind convicting you of anything. They won't even accuse you of doing anything wrong. And another way I look at this, if they were doing their job and keeping drugs out of the country and out of the town, and therefore out of my business completely, I shouldn't even have to be dealing with this stuff. That's the job of law enforcement, not some motel owner who has zero training in any of this stuff. But they fail to do that and then want to steal my property and reward themselves for their own failure. It's just hard to believe it's even going on in America. It's something you'd expect under a dictator or something.
I guess you never revealed to anybody about your x-ray vision being able to see through the motel walls. So.
Exactly. You know, they say another thing, well, they should have done more. And in fact, the judge asked him, and I think it was in court, or it might have been at a site visit out here, they come out and walked around. But anyway, the judge asked one of the prosecutors, well, what would you like him to do? What do you think he should be doing that he's not already doing? And she says, well, that's up to him to figure out. They just want to criticize, but will come up with nothing specific that I should do that I'm not already doing.
And of course, I just laughed, but this absolutely was not a laughing matter.
Yeah, if it wasn't the seriousness of this, it would be funny. It's almost like somebody's expect to have a skit on Saturday Night Live or something.
Right, exactly. And it's still going on. And this is what's significant about what we're going to talk about here. And thank you for explaining to the listeners this stuff, because this is a topic that should be discussed regularly, because
right.
The government didn't get away with it with Russ Caswell, but they are getting away with it with other people. There are other people that are in their sights, and they're taking their property away because they can't afford. Now, you laid out about $100,000 of your own money, right, for legal fees. Did you get that back?
I will be.
Oh, that's great.
I'm still going back.
All right, good, excellent. Oh, that's great, Russ.
Yeah.
Of course, they can't give you any compensation for the aggravation you had to put up with. Your wife got ill, and your whole family was, of course, sick to their stomach with what could have happened, but at least you'll get that money back. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
It just throws everybody's life into turmoil. You know, it's kind of in the back of your mind, not that you think about it or talk about it a lot, but, you know, it's America, and in your mind, you're thinking the laws are on your side. If you do the right thing, everything's going to be fine. And you expect the government to, you know, be on your side. And yet here, they're trying to steal property from the very people they're supposed to be protecting. And for all the effort they put into this thing with me, imagine if they had put that effort into actually going after some drug dealers and stuff.
Exactly. Than
exactly. A normal person. And another thing, people, I don't know, I can't stress enough, people just don't realize what this law is. If you own anything, I don't care what it is, even a vacant lot. Say you own a vacant lot, apartment house, a garage, a pizza parlor, anything. And you're renting it out to somebody. And somebody does something on that property, some sort of a drug deal. you can lose your property. They confiscate your property, and now you have to prove you didn't know anything about it. And in court, actually, the judge even asked the prosecutor that. She says, you mean to tell me if a couple of people pull into a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot and do some sort of drug deal, and the employees happen to see the police there, that you can seize the Dunkin' Donuts? And the prosecutor says, yes.
Wow. Of course, they would never go after, and we've discussed this before, the big guys like Dunkin' Donuts, but because they have crack legal teams, which you did have, fortunately, because the Institute for Justice came to your rescue, fortunately, thank goodness, because like you said, if it wasn't for them, it is a matter of having the resources to be able to fight it. This happens not just in these matters, but in many matters. Incredible stuff. Now, what's even more incredible, Russ, and I got so happy and excited when I saw this on your Facebook page, was that you were asked to go down to Washington, D.C. for this legislative briefing. Why don't you tell the listeners about how this all happened? When did you first hear about it and all that stuff?
I knew this was coming for a while. The Institute for Justice is trying to get this law changed or just done away with totally, but at least changed to something to make some sort of sense other than this thing. But anyway, this was a briefing. From what I understand, this stuff is all new to me. I've never been involved in anything like this, but it was at the Rayburn House office building in Washington. And from what I understand, these were congressmen's aides at this briefing. And from what I understand, they go to these meetings that people have for different reasons, and they bring it back to the congressman and say, hey, this is something you might want to look into, you know, I guess just to filter out people that are just complaining about nothing, I guess. But judging by my reaction there, I only got to talk for, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes or something. There was maybe, I guess, I didn't count the people, but 75 to 100 people there. There were some reporters, I guess, and I'm not really sure what they all were, but just their reaction. People were just like shaking their heads when I was telling this story as if to say, what the heck is this all about? I got them to laugh a little bit. There was one thing they said to me in court, the prosecutor. Now think about this. This is a motel. You're trying to get customers in. You're trying to get business in. And the prosecutor is just desperate to come up with something that makes sense about why they're even doing this. And so she says to me, do you have no trespassing signs up? And the judge at that point just kind of rolled her eyes as if to say, what the heck are you talking about? And the people at this briefing, they all started laughing because the case towards the end just became pretty much laughable. Some of the ridiculous stuff they were coming up with. And after I told the story, which is kind of what I've just been saying here, at the end of it, I was talking with three or four people come up to me and were asking me questions. And one fellow that kind of stuck in my mind, I didn't pay a lot of attention to his rank or whatever, but he was an ex-law enforcement officer. For a DEA officer, a DEA person anyway. He says, you know, I'd like to apologize for my profession. He says, I'm just ashamed of this. He says, this is disgusting. So it just felt good coming from a law enforcement person.
That is good, because they're probably stuck between a rock and a hard place having to do these things to innocent Americans.
Exactly. Like I say, when people hear about this, they can't believe it. Until they realize that, hey, this could happen to me. If the government happens to want my property, or if I pay my property off and have a lot of equity in it, they can just come and take it. And another thing, I've said this a few times, and I mentioned this, and this really got their attention at this meeting. When we deposed a DEA agent that's on one of these complaints against us when this first started, my lawyer asked him, how do you pick a property to go after? You go after one property and not another. And he says, well, I go over the internet and maybe talk with local police or whatever to try to find some place that's had some kind of drug arrest or something at it. He says, and then I go to the Registry of Deeds and see who owns the property and how much equity the owner has in the property. And my lawyer asked him, he said, what's the equity position have to do with this? And he says, well, the DEA won't go after a property unless the owner has at least $50,000 worth of equity in it. So right there it tells you they're looking for money, not to solve any kind of drug issues. Now, there's two or three other businesses right near me here. One is a Motel 6, another's a Home Depot, and then there's a big shopping center parking lot. And my lawyer looked into the drug problems they have at those places, which are more than they've had at my place. And they don't go after them at all. They just go after me because I'm the small guy.
Right.
Pretty much tells you what this is all about.
It's shocking that the guy not only said what he said, but that it sounds like he just said it as a matter of factly.
Yeah, and I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it came out in his deposition, and one of the prosecutors was there, and she used one of these legal terms. Well, you do understand that that came out accidentally or something. I guess he said it when he shouldn't have revealed that. I think it was a mistake that he said it. My lawyer says to him, well, you can't unhear something, you know.
We could laugh now, like I said, but while it was happening, I know, because we were talking, and it was not fun for you or your family.
Oh,
your friend.
It was horrible. You know, you just, like I say, it's just hard to believe this is America when something like this goes on. And I'm still having a hard time swallowing this. is, you know. It's like, what happened to this country? When did this happen? You know, you wonder how this law was ever put into effect in the first place, that somebody would come up with something about, oh, here, we can go steal people's property and never accuse them of anything.
The summary here of what you have on your Facebook page, in 2012 alone, so this is last year alone, assets deposited into the Department of Justice's Asset Forfeiture Fund, the federal government's largest forfeiture fund, exceeded $4 billion. That's a 960% increase just since 2001.
Right. Most of it taken from people that haven't done anything.
Exactly.
Now, I'm not trying to make anybody think that I'm against forfeiture laws in general. I mean, great, if they're taking stuff from drug dealers or that kind of thing. But they're using this to steal property from people who have done absolutely nothing. I don't know. I keep saying it, but I still have a hard time understanding how this law even ever got passed in the first place.
Well, yeah, and you should keep saying it because you got to keep this in the forefront and because you're never going to understand how this law got passed in the first place. Russ, when did they contact you? Of course, this hearing was July 16th, so about a week ago, Tuesday, July 16th. When did they contact you about this to see if you could be there? What was it, the Institute of Justice who contacted you?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. I'd say maybe a couple of weeks before that. But I've told them, I said, anytime you want me for anything, you don't even have to ask. Just set it up and I'll be there. You know, this is one of them things, it doesn't just get you mad. It kind of gets you right to the core, you know, like, this just is totally wrong, and I'm going to do whatever possible I can to change it.
Yeah, well, and that's great because that's what the government has a great ability, a great talent of doing. They go so far over the edge that they turn average Americans into activists.
Yeah.
And that's what they did
do.
To you.
Who can just sit by and watch this happen and not do anything about it? I was ready to fight it down on my lap if I was, you know, ended up out on the sidewalk because this is just completely wrong. It's not even debatable that it's wrong. You know, anybody that says this is the way things should be, to me, has got some kind of problem. And the judge saw right through their thing. If you read her decision, it's on the Institute for Justice website there. It's a 59-page decision. She saw right through their case. I wouldn't say she was on our side, but there was nothing in that 59 pages like she said, well, geez, maybe you should have done this, maybe you should have done nothing. It was all against what they were trying to do. She just saw right through all their smoke and mirrors and so on.
Did you drive down from Massachusetts to D.C., or did they fly you down? Did they bring you down? How did that work out?
Yeah, they got me tickets, and I flew down. I just went down for the meeting, that's all, and come back the same day. My wife, she's doing good now, but she's had a real hard time with heart trouble and stuff, so I don't like to go away for too long. My daughter stays with her when I'm gone. I only like to leave for a day. So, in fact, I'm going back to Washington this Sunday. It's a little different than this. I went to it last year. The Institute for Justice puts it on, and there's a bunch of student lawyers there. It's an all-weekend-long thing. And I just tell my story, you know, kind of what I'm telling you, and then they ask questions and so on. And they have a different group of student lawyers there every year, so I told them I'd do that as long as I
can. That's really cool. What a great group, the Institute for Justice.
Oh, they're a fantastic bunch of people. They really know what they're doing, and they treat you well. You know, I mean, they're very educated people, smart people. You know, they treat you as one of them, not just some guy that doesn't know much, you know. So they're just a great bunch of people.
Right, well, if it's not your line of work, right? I mean,
yeah, this is all totally out of my area. You know, I was never involved in anything like this.
And now you're a regular on the Washington, D.C. lecture circuit, Russ.
I guess so. You know, who'd have thought?
That's great. Russ, I'm so happy that it turned out this way. And I'm so happy that you're getting involved in educating people and, of course, educating new lawyers who should be aware of this. And the Institute for Justice, like we said, has done such a great thing here in protecting you, protecting your rights, and making sure that these people, I don't know what to call them. I know you're at a loss for words. For
yeah, I have
their
a hard time with that word, too.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hesitate myself.
Exactly. We're both at a loss for words of how to really talk to these people because they're not regular people. They wouldn't
they wouldn't do this.
Yeah, they wouldn't do this.
I couldn't imagine myself doing to somebody else what they tried to do to me. I just couldn't imagine doing that. I just said, here, you have fun. I'm gone or something. I just wouldn't.
Hopefully, with what you're doing, with what IJ is doing, with what other people are doing, these laws will be overturned. And Russ, I want to thank you again so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners. And I always enjoy having you on and discussing this. And again, I'm so happy that it turned out favorably. And next time something significant happens with you out there in D.C. or elsewhere, I'd love to have you back on.
No, I'd be glad to. Anytime you want me for anything, just give a call. I'd be more than happy to do whatever I can to expose this stuff, whatever it takes, just to get the word out for people to understand just how totally wrong this thing is.
Thanks, Russ. I appreciate that.